Today is Wednesday, April 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as U.S. coronavirus cases rise and the president looks to reopen for business, the top health chief warns it shouldn't be rushed.
It could be a rebound to get us right back in the same boat that we were in a few weeks ago.
Human Rights Watch is warning children could be the biggest victims of the pandemic. Also ahead, another group of international entertainers plan a big live stream concert this weekend. It's all on today's International Edition. COVID-19 cases in the U.S. topped 1 million on Tuesday, making up one-third of cases worldwide. More than 58,000 Americans have died from the highly contagious illness, and new projections show there will be more than 74,000 American coronavirus deaths by August. As President Trump continues to focus heavily on reopening the economy, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke to the Economic Club of Washington, D.C. Tuesday and said it must be done very carefully.
If we are unsuccessful or prematurely try to open up and we have additional outbreaks that are out of control, it could be much more than that. It could be a rebound to get us right back in the same boat that we were in a few weeks ago.
Fauci also said he has no doubt there will be more cases.
So it's not going to disappear from the planet, which means as we get into next season, in my mind, it's inevitable that we will have a return of the virus, or maybe it never even went away.
President Trump on Tuesday said the U.S. is considering having passengers coming in on international flights from coronavirus hotspots to be tested for the virus. Trump also took an executive action to order meat processing plants to stay open. The United Food and Commercial Workers International Union says 20 union workers have died from the virus and an estimated 6,500 are sick or have been exposed to the virus while working near someone who tested positive. As AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports, President Trump's order came amid concerns over closures and the nation's food supply.
Industry leaders have warned Americans could see chicken, pork, and other meat shortages on store shelves in days after workers at major facilities tested positive for the virus and some of the nation's biggest processing plants closed. South Dakota Senator Mike Rounds tells the AP things will get worse as people get worried.
And people start to do the same thing to the meat supplies as they did to toilet paper. You're going to see the shelves bare fairly quickly.
He'd asked the president to use the Defense Production Act to classify meat processing as critical infrastructure to keep plants open. The president agreed, but disputed there will be any shortages, saying the supply chain had simply hit a roadblock.
There's plenty of supply.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Republican-run Senate is returning to session next week as President Donald Trump accused the Democratic-led House of Representatives of not wanting to work. Joining us to talk about the decision not to return is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, wasn't the U.S. House of Representatives also expected to return next week?
Well, the U.S. House actually had a stumbling block happen Tuesday. They had expected to come back to Washington, D.C. for a full session of lawmaking next week. But House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer actually announced Tuesday that they would not be doing that after consultation with U.S. Capitol physicians. And that came as quite a surprise to reporters here in Washington, D.C., that abrupt schedule change, because they had just announced that they were indeed coming back. And the U.S. Senate is still set to come back on May 4th. So a little bit of disarray here as lawmakers try to scramble for a kind of in-between compromise where they're still working remotely and doing a lot of those committee reports, committee hearings that you would see when they're in town in Washington, D.C. They're just going to move all of that online.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he wants the Senate to come back and work in person on Capitol Hill, but apparently that's not the case in the House with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What is her reasoning? What is she saying?
Well, what's really interesting about the differing situations between between the Senate and the House is that the leadership in both chambers actually consults with the same U.S. Capitol physician on the health and safety for lawmakers. So they're receiving the same advice on the pandemic from the same Capitol physician. Whatever that physician told Mitch McConnell made him feel as though he could bring senators back to town to work next week. Whatever Nancy Pelosi heard from that physician made her think that the situation was still too dangerous. And I think also a lot of the input from her rank and file members has some input here as well. Lots of members were saying that they did not feel safe flying back into town, gathering with people from all different parts of the country, mixing in large groups, and then flying back to their home districts next weekend. I mean, really, when you think about it, the U.S. House is a perfect situation for the spread of a virus. Nancy Pelosi made that determination that lawmakers were better off working remotely, continuing to do that work remotely as the House tries to find some interim solution when they need to vote on legislation.
Is there any reason why they would need to be there in person other than voting? Are they looking for ways to try to vote remotely?
They actually had a planned vote on April 23rd to change the House rules so that they could vote on legislation remotely. That vote was scrapped after House Republican leadership voiced concerns about changing the House rules. You know, the U.S. House of Representatives is a very tradition-bound institution. A lot of these procedures have been in place for decades and were in place well before there were any online video conferencing platforms that could help facilitate this. Of course, we know that we have this ability now. It's a matter of getting, you know, the House leadership, who is in their older years, to come around to this idea of new forms of technology and operating in a new way. And I think what you've seen through the coronavirus pandemic is a realization that they really need to face up to this reality. They need to have an operating plan in place in case these types of things.
That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, ready or not, Greece is opening back up, but it is not happening all at once as the government plans to lift coronavirus restrictions in phases, keeping a ban on religious services to contain new outbreaks of COVID-19. The plan has infuriated the Greek Orthodox Church, and it's now demanding preference over businesses like hair and nail salons. Anthea Karasava has the story from Athens.
The standoff comes as Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis announces a gradual easing of draconian lockdown measures imposed here since early March. Government officials tell VOA schools and small-sized businesses will be among the first to open next week. Church doors will also be unlocked, but only to allow followers to enter and pray on their own, not in large numbers and not for religious services. The country's archbishop has sent a stern letter to the prime minister, pressing him to reconsider. But on Tuesday, the church's spokesperson, the metropolitan of Naupactos, Ierothos, accused the government of staging what he called a coup against the country's religious authority. What do they really think the church is, he asked in front of reporters Tuesday. Do they consider it like another supermarket or union or nail and hair salon? The church, he says, has been a guiding force for the nation and part of Greek tradition for more than 200 years. It's unlikely the prime minister will back down from his plans, aides say. The country's senior council of prelates, meantime, is scheduling a crisis meeting later this week. It wants to see churches open across the nation soon, in order to hold belated Easter services in May, services it has suspended as part of nationwide efforts to contain the spread of the coronavirus. The controversy is fueling a debate in Greece on whether the state should reconsider its close ties with the Greek Orthodox Church. Commentator Nikos Vlavianos, known for his left-wing views, argues for a separation. He calls this type of intervention absurd, and he says it reminds the world that in the 21st century, church and state are not separated in Greece. About 90% of Greeks identify as Orthodox Christians, although it is unclear how many of them regularly attend church. The Orthodox Church is deeply intertwined with the society of Greece, predating the Greek state by some 1,500 years. Throughout the history, attempts to separate the two have met resistance, with many Greeks citing the Church's key role in preserving the Orthodox faith for during 400 years of Ottoman rule. Anthika Rasava for VOA News, Athens.
The International Monetary Fund expects Africa's GDP to shrink by 1.6% in 2020, its worst result ever recorded. European Union country leaders held video talks on Tuesday to discuss debt relief for vulnerable nations on the continent in an effort to help them cope with the coronavirus. Africa is seen as particularly vulnerable to the pandemic, as experts fear weak healthcare systems may not be able to stem the spread of the virus. Joining us for an update on the EU proposals is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, which countries did they focus on in their relief effort discussions?
The main focus for Europe really is the G5 Sahel. And the reason for that is that conflict and poverty in the G5 Sahel region is the main driver of migration to Europe. It creates instability in Europe. So that's where the focus is. Now, the decision by the EU, which are also there with the five Sahel leaders and representatives from the United Nations and the African Union Commission, the push for this debt relief has really been the realization that countries in that region and many other parts of Africa are now paying more money financing their foreign debt than they are on public health. And public health now is the big issue that's going to and has the possibility of creating more instability, particularly the coronavirus, when there are projections that there could be as many as 10 million cases of coronavirus in Africa within the next 3 to 6 months. So the realization that so much money is being paid just to service these debts at a time when African nations need that money to go into the healthcare is what's pushing the European Union to really pick up just the idea. All countries have got to come together and just, if not a moratorium, then some way that Africa doesn't have to pay these huge interests and principals on their debt.
Africa, so far, we haven't seen very high numbers of COVID-19, but obviously we know the continent is very vulnerable for this pandemic, and it's probably just that it hasn't either reached the peak there or they just lack testing. Obviously, though, the effect of the lockdown and given the uncertainty of what will happen with this pandemic and the vulnerability there, it makes sense.
It does indeed. And that was one of the reasons why Charles Michel, the head of the European Council, announced that there would be some 4.5 billion euros in financial aid, particularly to the G5 Sahel countries, to meet possible public health emergencies. So they are realizing that money has to flow and that something's got to be done. And you know, when you look at some of the other funds that are going into it, you know, we've already had the EU 2 years ago give 250 million euros in humanitarian aid to that region. So there is a realization that a lot has to be done or else it really is just going to get worse. But having said that, the European Union itself is in a difficult position because it's having to rework budgets now. They're going into a new budget term, the 2020 to 2027 budget term. They're still working out how much money they're going to have, how much money they can give. So they're having their own problems. They can't give the answers that the African partners would want. But the answer they can give, and that was the message that came, was that they do realize that there needs to be some sort of African debt relief. It does have to be an international approach. And there also needs to be an approach which brings in everything else that comes along with helping Africa. And that means helping restore the state in all these areas, helping development, helping to fight terrorism, and really to commit to helping the security and development of the whole region.
Catherine, I thought the G20 earlier in the month already vowed to freeze any debt repayments for the world's poorest nations, of course, many of which are in Africa.
Indeed, but it was just a postponement until 2022. And even then, it's not really enough. And when you just look at some of the figures of what African countries owe, let's just look at one figure we've got, which is $365 billion is what African countries owe in interest and principal payments. That is their international debt.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, thanks for being with us. Well, the Norwegian Refugee Council is calling for economic sanctions to be lifted on countries struggling with widespread unemployment and mass hunger due to state-mandated coronavirus lockdowns. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 212,000 people globally have lost their lives to the coronavirus, according to the Johns Hopkins University. At the same time, millions of the most vulnerable people have lost their jobs and incomes because of lockdowns aimed at containing the spread of the deadly virus. The Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, says the socioeconomic effects of the lockdown may be tougher and kill more people than the infection itself.
I think we will see many local collapses where vulnerable people end up in horrific hunger, horrific problems, horrific violence because of societal breakdown. We urge governments to do away with politically motivated blanket economic sanctions of entire nations and people.
Egeland notes thousands of Venezuelans who had fled to Colombia to escape hardship in their country have returned home. He explains work had dried up in Colombia. He says a recent survey in Jordan by his organization found 90% of refugees have lost their jobs since coronavirus restrictions and lockdowns were introduced. Egeland says economic sanctions imposed on Iran, Venezuela, Syria, and elsewhere may have been imposed for good reasons, but in the time of coronavirus, they are having a devastating impact on the very people they were meant to help. He adds the sanctions also are making it more difficult for humanitarian organizations like his to work and serve ordinary people who are in desperate need of help. Egeland says there should be a moratorium on economic sanctions for the duration of the COVID-19 pandemic. He is calling for blanket exemptions on all medical, humanitarian, and food aid, as well as on computer software needed for remotely educating children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Human rights groups say children could be the biggest victims of the COVID-19 pandemic, despite the fact that the disease affects mostly older people. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the most obvious impact is the number of children missing out on their education.
Children could be the biggest victims of the COVID-19 pandemic, despite the fact that the disease affects mostly older people, say human rights groups. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the most obvious impact is the number of children missing out on their education. Empty classrooms being disinfected in Wuhan, China, where the coronavirus pandemic began. It's estimated that globally 1.5 billion children are missing school. Human Rights Watch says the outbreak is having myriad impacts on young people. Joe Becker from Human Rights Watch says the outbreak is having myriad impacts on young people.
More and more children are going to be left without parents. And we've seen from the Ebola crisis, for example, the HIV epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa, that when children are orphaned, they become much more vulnerable to sex trafficking, to child labor, and other forms of exploitation.
A recent report from the International Labor Organization warned 200 million people could lose their jobs as a result of the pandemic.
As parents lose their employment, especially in developing countries, we often see more and more children pushed into child labor to try and help families just meet their basic needs. And correspondingly, there's also a trend towards early and child marriage, with girls feeling the pressure to marry to get out of the house and relieve the pressure on their parents.
It is the most vulnerable who feel the effects first. These children live on the streets of Dakar, Senegal. Life is getting even tougher under lockdown. 17-year-old Bamba Sek says before the coronavirus, we were asking for food from people. But with the disease, everyone started to be wary and to take safety measures. They stopped giving us food. In rich countries, poorer children are missing out on school lunches, often their one big meal of the day. This was the line recently outside a school in New York, which has begun serving food to all members of the local community. Raylan Riviera is a 17-year-old high school student in New York.
It's a bit tough right now, considering we don't really have work to get food. So we have to make do what we have.
With the country in lockdown, activists in Russia report a big spike in domestic violence, a pattern repeated in many countries around the world. Again, Joe Becker.
As parents become anxious about their health, about their finances, about their jobs, and tensions rise as people are sort of together 24/7, the risk of violence really escalates.
There are also concerns that children are missing out on vital immunization programs as health systems prioritize coronavirus patients. Human Rights Watch is urging governments to put children at the center of their coronavirus response policies, with greater efforts to expand access to education and to provide economic assistance to vulnerable families. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Negotiations between the European Union and ex-member Britain over new trade arrangements next year are at an impasse, according to diplomats and officials at the EU bloc's headquarters in Brussels. Talks between EU leaders and Prime Minister Boris Johnson were renewed a week ago, but have apparently already hit snags. Britain is also on track to record one of the worst coronavirus death tolls in Europe. Research from Germany and Italy suggests that footballers and other athletes face a particular risk of the coronavirus infecting their lungs, raising major questions over attempts to restart professional soccer. The research, produced by Italian immunologists and lung specialists based at institutes in Berlin, Rome, and Verona, suggests that due to strenuous exercise, elite athletes are more likely to inhale virus particles and direct them to the lower areas of the lung. With military cemeteries and ceremonies off limits, Israelis went online Tuesday to mourn their war dead in annual remembrances held under the shadow of the coronavirus crisis. As on every Memorial Day, a siren to honor soldiers and Israeli civilians killed in Palestinian bombings and other attacks sounded in the morning. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all these skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. As speculation swirls over the whereabouts and health of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, a South Korean minister said Tuesday that fear of catching the coronavirus may be the reason for Kim's absence from a key holiday in mid-April, as questions remain as to why Kim has been absent from public view for more than 2 weeks. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Depending on which rumor you prefer, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is missing because he suffered an ankle sprain, underwent failed heart surgery, had a kidney malfunction, went into lockdown to avoid the coronavirus, or sustained injuries during a botched missile test. Over the past week, South Korean and Western newspapers have published a diverse range of rumors about Kim's health, none of which are verified. Though more rumors emerge every day, nothing is known about the status of Kim, who was last seen on April 11th. The rumors began spreading after Kim skipped an anniversary for his late grandfather, Kim Il-sung, North Korea's founder. Analyst Frank Aum says it was a notable absence.
The anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birthday is the biggest holiday in North Korea, so it's very unusual for Kim Jong-un to not be present at the celebration of this very important event.
North Korea has not responded to the rumors. Its state media have instead provided only passing indications, but no proof that Kim is still conducting official business. That's not enough for analysts like Aum.
These things don't come out of nowhere. At the same time, the details may not be exact. So I think what we know right now is that Kim Jong-un is experiencing some health issues, but beyond that, the details we can't be too sure of.
It isn't the first time Kim, an obese 36-year-old cigarette smoker, has gone missing amid health concerns. In 2014, he was absent from public view for 41 days before emerging using a cane. U.S. President Donald Trump, who met Kim three times, has been ambiguous about Kim's status. On Monday, Trump was asked if he had any updates on Kim.
Yes, I do have a very good idea, but I can't talk about it now. I just wish him well. I've had a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un.
South Korea on Tuesday called the rumors fake news, saying there is no reason to believe Kim has a health problem. But if Kim were unable to lead, it's unclear who would succeed him. He is thought to have children, but they're too young. His brother is non-political. His sister, Kim Yo-jong, may not be able to gain enough support in North Korea's male-dominated society. It raises the possibility that for the first time in North Korea's history, a Kim may not be in charge. That is, if there is anything to the rumors. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
When HIV/AIDS spread around the world in the 1980s, so did HIV/AIDS denialism. Today, there is a new phenomenon spreading of COVID-19 coronavirus denialism. In both cases, denialists refuse to accept the existence of the outbreaks or downplay their severity. In the U.S., they've rallied in state capitals to protest scientific public health measures, lockdowns. For more on the COVID-19 denialism trend, Dr. Tara Smith, an epidemiologist at Kent State University in Ohio who studies science denialism, talked about it with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Dr. Smith begins by explaining some of the beliefs held by HIV deniers.
Some of them deny that the HIV virus exists at all. They think it's not an actual virus. Some completely deny the germ theory. They don't think that infectious diseases cause any harm to people. Some of them just think that HIV and AIDS are things that are made up by big pharmaceutical companies to sell drugs. So there's a wide array of beliefs within that. The central core of it is just that they don't accept that the HIV pandemic exists.
What kind of impact has that denialism had on the fight against HIV and AIDS?
It's made it more difficult. I mean, people become skeptical of pharmaceutical companies. They become skeptical of medical doctors. They don't necessarily believe in HIV testing. Then if they are infected, they may continue to spread that because they don't acknowledge their own infection. In South Africa, for a while, this was basically government policy with Mbeki, who brought in mostly American HIV deniers and really had that as part of his government policy that, you know, HIV was not a thing. It did not cause AIDS. And so that led to deaths of hundreds of thousands of individuals.
Now, today, we have COVID-19, and there are many people around the world who either deny that it's a big problem, and even there are some people who say it's made up, that it's not real. Would you say that we are now also facing COVID-19 denialism?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing that in the United States already. Some of the protesters who are protesting to kind of reopen things, you know, suggest that it doesn't exist or it's a big pharma plot. All of these same conspiracy theories that basically we have seen over the years with HIV denialists are just being kind of co-opted for COVID-19. The arguments are exactly the same thing. We're just switching out the virus.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us. Take care and be well. I'm lost, but I'm hopeful.